Welcome to 60 Scales and the Truth, a podcast where amazing guitar players reflect on their lives and on how they got where they are today. My name is Niels Guns. I'm a journalist, podcast maker, and a guitar fanatic. Thanks for tuning in. My guest today is a player who mixes country, metal, blues, and rock in a very appealing way. His debut album, released in 1990, is a milestone for many guitar players. I myself, at least, listened to it about a million times. His unique tone and craftsmanship are undeniable. Welcome to this episode, Michael Lee Firkins.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Michael, you're at the end of a tour right now.
Yeah,
just wrapped up. What will you do when you get back home, the first thing?
I'm super excited to get right on some songs that I've written recently. So that's the only thing that I feel starved musically right now, because I just got to play for almost a month every night. And so I feel really fulfilled with that. And that'll carry for a while now. I won't be so antsy to get out and do something. So I have a whole bunch of material that I'm always writing, but especially there's a couple songs I've written and I'm excited to get right to doing them. So
has that always been like that? You write a lot?
No.
How did that grow?
I don't know. I want to say little over 15 years ago, just everything started going at a much better, faster pace with writing.
But that's interesting. That's about the time when you, the pace of you releasing albums went down. Right?
I mean, I think between the past 10 years is probably
Your last album.
I've done that before. I think I've went 10 years without putting something out before. So it's probably just average, but maybe 15 years ago, I started writing a lot more music and it's accelerating all the time now. So almost every day I write something, and quite often it's a pretty complete thing, or I make it into a complete thing. So instead of just saying, oh, this is this, I really like this, I'm going to work on this for a long time till it's right, I'm doing the opposite with a lot of that material and just saying, you know, let's throw it up on the chalkboard right now into the session. Let's get drums, bass, keyboards on it, and vocals right now. Well, not, I always do the vocals last, so it's usually all the bed tracks. So I'm the past, I want to say 3-4 years, that's my new approach with new material. Otherwise, it's just so much of it.
You get lost.
Some of it'll just fade away. Mm-hmm. So I'm just trying to, I always record everything. Every single thing I play is recorded.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Wow.
So either on a memo or, you know.
Have you archived it properly?
Well, I backed up the drive before I left town. So that's all I can say is I want multiple copies of it so it's protected. Because I have so much material now that if I just keep going the way I'm going, it won't get finished. And, we don't always have the ability to finish our music. Mm. We think we do, but so I just want to get as much of it done or at least demoed right away. So the past 4 years, if I come up with something, I say, I'm going to just take that right now. And it might not even have all the parts, but I'm going to make the parts right now. And so I throw it down, throw a click, then I throw the guitar down. And then, that's usually one take. And then I do the drums after that. And that's usually, about 5 to 10 takes of drums. And then I listen to all those drum tracks for a couple days and I comp a nice drum track. And then as soon as I really like the drums, then I bring in, I do the bass guitar. Mm. And then after that, I do the B3. I bought a B3 about 4 years ago. So I put organ on that a lot of the time. And so then I have a track,
what will you do with it? Releasing it all.
There's so much different type of stuff and I'm evolving as a recorder and a writer. So I'm just happy that I have the material. Because that's the happiest you'll ever be. It's not releasing material. It's making the material.
Yeah, of course.
So I'm happy. Right. So, And I'm not happy with Spotify and Apple Music and any of that. So I'm in no hurry to do that. So, but I do need to put something out. If I could get my touring situation bigger, then I would just sell them at the shows.
Yeah, of course.
But I'm not there yet. So I'll probably have to put something out on those Spotify things at some point, but hopefully not a whole record. I'll just do separate songs. Mm-hmm. And that's all I know.
Hey, but what changed about 15 years ago that you think, hey, there's a burst of creativity, apparently, right? And that you started writing so much more.
I think just having a studio that you have privacy.
Oh, yeah. That focus is very important.
So I found a place that was private enough, that had enough cement so nobody could hear me.
Mm.
And it was in the corner of a building that was fully cement. And I started working nights. So I was going from 10 p.m. to like 5 a.m.
Uh-huh. So was that at your home or away from
home? That was down the road at this kind of a creepy industrial park. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a creepy studio, but it was made by a guy who really cared and really intelligent guy built this studio. Mm-hmm. It was very well done. It even had Neve preamps and everything. And I just went in and rented it for like $1,000 a month. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty cheap. And so I was able to, I had never worked nights before. I'm not a night guy. I'm not that way at all. So mm-hmm. I had to do that. And I had to go through a bunch of things to keep myself awake with coffee and all the other stuff.
So you were writing and recording
playing,
at night?
Writing, recording, and playing. So when I'm recording music and I'm really working on it hard, that's when other things come. Because you're so sick of the stuff you're working on because you have to try so hard and there's so much pressure involved in that you instantly think, I can do better than this. And so you try to do better than that, and you're starting to develop new material. It comes just like that. So it's usually confusing. You're supposed to be working on this other stuff, but all this new material starts coming, and that still happens a lot.
Why at night? Why did you choose?
I'm just saying that, it just happened that way because I had a daughter, and I wanted to spend time with her in the daytime,
and I
just wanted to be I would just sleep in the morning, mm-hmm. and then I'd have the whole rest of the day to not have to worry until she's in bed, she's asleep. And so then I would leave and go, drink some coffee and go to the studio starting at 10 p.m.
That's a perfect solution because I have kids myself, and I'm like, how do people do this with kids?
I'll tell you, when I look back at those photos of the way I looked after staying up all night, I look better now than I looked 15 years ago. So I would never do it again.
Mm.
If naturally, I think when we get older, maybe that you start waking up at night. But
I'm
not a night person. I only did that to get into that mode. And it was fun because I would get really high in the middle of the night. That's how I stayed awake. I wouldn't smoke in the daytime whatsoever. And then in the middle of the night when I started to fade, I would get high and that stuff wakes me up. And I would drink coffee and do that. And it's a weird at 3 a.m. when everyone's asleep, there's a really weird energy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fun. I had a good time. I wouldn't want to do that again,
Yeah, but still at that point you had some sort of urge to find that focus, right? Because you have kids, that space it changes, right? Like
But the focus never changes. That's my main drive. Every day I live for music.
Mm.
Yeah. But it's a problem. because it's an obsessive compulsive disorder that is fun. Uh-huh. And it gives you purpose.
Yeah.
So you strive to just do better all the time. But mainly having a privacy space is how I'm writing music. If I didn't have privacy, I don't know. I can still write in a room like this,
mm-hmm.
and I can.
We're in a hotel
now.
Room,
I
by
can,
the way. Yeah.
but I couldn't before. Like now, I can just play my electric unplugged, right? And I could even sing a melody in a falsetto. I don't have to belt it out really loud, and I can write a song, in the middle of the night without screaming. Mm-hmm. And I do a lot. I do that a lot. I'll travel and I'll bring my guitars with me, and I write songs in hotels all the time.
But so, I read in an interview as well that you there was a period in your life that you hardly touched the guitar.
Yeah, I did.
What happened then?
I don't know. That was just I want to say I started playing acoustic guitar, slide guitar. And so it just started, and I started listening and started writing vocal songs, and it became more of an art form than just guitar, you know, and life became more of a life than just playing guitar. So it was just, it's more of an art form to me now. So this tour was actually really difficult because I'm, you know, most of the time don't play hours of guitar. I'll only play as a writer, and I'll come in and I'll just, you know, I love playing, but I won't probably play more than an hour, you know? So, but writing, if I just wait for the right time of the day, I just, the first thing I come up with, I have a new riff, and 20 minutes later I have a new thing and I'm happy. And that's as happy as I'll ever be. That's happier than executing a guitar line precisely, even in a live situation. So, you know, I just like the creativity of music, you know.
I think for me, your writing is your technique, of course, as well, but your writing is the more appealing thing to me, because I put on your debut album 2 months ago for the first time in a long time. And it struck me, like, I still remember all the melodies. They're so strong, you know, so such strong melodies. And like, oh, I haven't listened to this in 20 years. And they're all still in my head.
Nice.
And I think that means the writing is mainly great.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's what, you know, maybe that's the thing. But to me, it was just organizing ideas, right? like organizing ideas. And of course, there's a guitar solo in the middle. And of course, I'm trying to write melodically. But I think just putting the things together, that's more important than even the Laughing Stack solo.
Yeah,
that's developed over years.
Mm.
There were three different demos of the song. And so it was a composed solo, basically. I think when I finally recorded it, there's a little bit of improv on some other parts that I hadn't done before. But
I hear it right now, actually.
Yeah.
It's crazy how it
right
works.
Now it's you know, I had, I think, two or three separate demos of the song, and they each changed. And then the solo evolved to where I'd be sitting practicing the solo years before I even, you know, recorded it. So that's a different approach. I don't do that now. I don't compose solos. It's the very opposite. I want to get a first or second or third take of just a feeling.
Yes.
And that's all. Because I'm, you know, I want to do a record like that someday and go back to doing some, you know, melodic stuff. And I have some tunes that are for a record that I've started. But in general, you know, I'm also okay with just a simple song with just vocals and acoustic guitar. And I also like slide guitar. And I like things that just sound like they're, I mean, it's so hard to sound natural and not sound like you're in the studio or something. And I like that too. I have to let music and mistakes go if I want to do things like that. It's not going to be perfect, and it shouldn't be. So, you know, but, you know, the composing is interesting, because I have friends that that's what they like. Like, if you ask them what they like, they say, oh man, you know, the Brian May composed solos. That's great. Right. And so I get it. So, and I'll be working with someone and I'll just like something that has a feeling like it's just new. Right. And they'll like it, but they'll say, but you know, they want to compose something, and that's valid. So, it'd be nice to do that again, but it takes time. Yeah, I mean, so I'm just more interested in the things that happen really quick, because it'll never get finished then. It's just too many things, and you know, and so it's nice to try to have music that is just going to be something that gets finished than anything, you know. So
hey, but let's look back a little bit. You start playing guitar when you're 8. And you grew up in Omaha, Nebraska. Did you feel right away, I'm actually quite good at this at already 8 years old? Or could you describe how getting in touch with the instrument felt for you as an experience?
I don't think I thought I was great. I didn't care. I was just really enjoying it. And so there was no trying to compare myself, because there wasn't as many guitar players back then. You know, I was probably the only guy of maybe one or two guys in my school that was trying to play, you know, for the choir or the, you know, stuff like that. So you just didn't think about other people playing or another guy showing up and being better than you or anything like that, right? So and I was just caught up with the songs at the time, which was, you know, Guitar Heaven, 1977 was, you know, Boston, Yes,
oh yeah,
you know, More Than a Feeling, Yes, Roundabout, Stairway to Heaven, the Dust in the Wind, the guitar anthems, right? So that was just everywhere. So, like I heard the Wayne's World thing, right? No Stairway to Heaven. Mm-hmm. Like I heard Stairway to Heaven at a music store before I knew who did it.
Oh yeah.
And you know, so then so you go to your guitar teacher and you say, hey, I keep hearing people play this song. And he goes, and he plays Stairway to Heaven. And so it was just all these guitar anthems. So I was just in heaven, guitar heaven. It was the peak of classic rock. And I just loved it. And,
So when did you realize, like, because at one point you must have realized, okay, I enjoy it and it can actually be something I do professionally. So when did that start?
I think you're just those years, you just dreamed of being a rock star. You just dreamed of being in some famous band. You didn't think it was a choice to make money. You just thought, oh, of course, all these people have lots of money. That'd be great. But more than that, they're famous with this music. So you're just dreaming of being a rock star. I never thought about any professional money, like how can I be in a band to make money? And all my bands didn't make money. We were on the road and we made nothing because we were traveling all the time. So, but we were able to eat somehow and, get to the next town. Right. So that was the only professional thing that I did, but I didn't do it for the money. I did it because I joined a band and they were going to travel. And so, and they're playing the songs of the 80s, right? Mid 80s. And so, but other than that, that was the only time I ever thought of, when I became a guitar teacher, you're making money doing that. So that was fun because I was young and I didn't have to work at the telemarketing job anymore. So then I could just teach guitar and that was great. But, it was just, making money. I didn't have to do the other job. So it was just fun. I could finally, you know, and it lasted until I got my record deal. And then I had to focus more on that. And so I moved and I stopped being a teacher, you know.
So what did it mean that when you got the record deal, actually the whole business of being a guitar player entered your life?
Even then, it was more about making the record. That's all you thought about, the songs. So it wasn't how much money am I going to make? You know, the record contracts are already complicated. So you felt like you had to sign it anyway because you had this opportunity, right? So you may have an attorney look over the contract, but you're still thinking in the back of your head, well, I'm going to sign this because this is it, right? So, but other than that, it was about the record.
If the attorney was going to say this means your death, okay, then maybe not.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But otherwise, go for it.
It didn't matter. So, only until maybe, you know, working with Yamaha guitars and they were paying me a lot of money to do guitar clinics. So that was nice. So then all of a sudden I was making money, but it was still never so much at once that you felt like, you know, I mean, you just were glad to make money, you know, but I owed money to the music store I worked at for guitars and, you know, so that money went quick. And then when I moved to California, there wasn't much money.
What age were you when you moved to California?
24.
Okay. And tell me about the music scene in Omaha then, because I looked up like people from like Elliott Smith were from there?
Well, he was born there.
He wasn't raised there.
He probably left when he was 1 month old.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
Then, yeah. I wish I knew Elliott Smith. I met him once.
Oh, yeah?
I met Elliott Smith.
Oh, really?
Once.
Okay.
So
he's brilliant. He was brilliant.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. But, you know, there's so many people out of Omaha. I find out more every day. There's a guy there who just died, and I didn't even know, but he was Ray Charles' guitar player in the 70s and all these. So there's a lot of people. Mm. But the music scene's just so different over the years. You know, they had a whole scene in the 60s and 70s, 80s, just like any town. Mm-hmm. So it goes kind of deep. But I wasn't a part of any music scene there mm-hmm. when I made my record. Mm-hmm. In fact, the only thing I ever did was join a band. We left Omaha to go travel, right? So we came back and played and had a great gig when we did all that. And once I put my record out, I did play Omaha one time and it was a great, great fun gig with lots of people, but I moved right after that. So I gave up my hometown, crowd, you know, mm-hmm. and that sucks. Yeah. You know what I mean? That really sucks because I still have friends there and family and I'd love to play more there, but you're not from there anymore you moved that long ago. And I still play there and it's fun and I could do more there and I'm going to try, but still it sucks mm-hmm. leaving your hometown crowd. I went to California and just started over, mm-hmm. you know, didn't even have a telephone, just went out there and lived in a house with two other guys and super cheap and just literally started everything over. It wasn't even about music at that point. I literally started a whole new world with people I didn't know anybody anywhere I went, and I started over like that. And
was after the release of your record, then, right?
Yeah. Right. But still, I moved to a small town area above San Francisco and just started over. And but the band I was in at that time, Howling Iguanas, we kind of caught the last end of a nice little kind of local music scene there before everything kind of turned the way everything is everywhere, right? They still had like Grateful Dead still lived, Jerry was alive, mm-hmm. and I know there was just a nice local scene there. So we played a little bit there, and but that band didn't work out, and I gave up a lot of my solo stuff and time I could have put in on that band. But I don't have any regrets because I was young and I was all of a sudden in California mm-hmm. and starting this whole new lifestyle of, you know, just a different thing, you know.
Tell me about that period. So you moved to California, and obviously your debut album was a success, right? I mean, it was instrumental music.
It was. Yamaha put a lot of money into advertising for me, and they even bought a lot of my CDs and gave them to music stores all over the world. Mm, so they bought like 30,000 or 40,000 CDs of mine.
Wow.
And I got paid for those, right? And those went all over the world. So all the dealers gave those out to all the music stores if you came and tried a Pacifica guitar, right?
I had a Pacifica. Right? I mean, everybody's just like, hey, Michael E. Ferkins. Yeah, man. I'm not as good, but.
They were great guitars. You know, that's just, you don't get better promotion than that. And they're an international company and they flew me around to these same places to show up and do clinics. Mm. I mean, you know, sometimes first class. Mm. I mean, we flew internationally first class. Mm. I mean, it was crazy, you know, and I wasn't used to anything like that. And, you know, so I wasn't analyzing it. I was just like, I literally was swept up in this thing. You know, I had never been to other countries. Mm. I never thought I'd be going to any countries. I didn't have any idea, mm-hmm. you know, and all of a sudden that was happening. And it was so much fun, you know, and I got to go to Japan. Like, I think I've been there 7 times, mm-hmm. you know, and I went there 2 or 3 times in the beginning. But so it was... The record was successful, although, you know, I just had fun mm-hmm. and really the mistake I made if I was trying to be a better businessman would have been to follow the record up mm-hmm. as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. And I didn't. So, and the music scene changed mm-hmm. really quickly.
You just mentioned the word successful. What does success mean for you? Just joy, actually? Is that really being successful?
Just being
successful?
Able to keep doing it, right? Mm-hmm. So obviously when, you know, if you take a lot of those things away, getting to do it seems harder. So you're not going to, you know, you might not be going to other countries anymore. And I didn't for a while. So I think I got a little bit of mileage out of it till 92, something, 93 maybe, right? But I remember landing in Europe for the first time and Roadrunner Records, right here in Amsterdam, right? Yeah. That was my label. Even they were saying, ah, even Steve Vai and Joe Satriani aren't selling well these days. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, that's kind of, I guess if you look at Satriani came out in 87, right? So things were fading, right? Grunge was coming in. So they were just telling me things like this, but hey, my record was still doing great because Yamaha was helping, right? Mm-hmm. So, and sometimes a record company doesn't realize that, right? Mm-hmm. They're just looking at their numbers and I'm getting all these free benefits in other areas. So they could have been more helpful if they would have looked at that, but they were still really good. I mean, they were still amazing and they helped with Yamaha. So when Yamaha came to town, Roadrunner Records was right there. So they were really good. But yeah, just being successful just at that time probably just meant, well, I didn't even realize it at the time, but I think by 96, I came back and played there. And that's kind of what one of those guys at Roadrunner said. They said, you know, you should have put out a record right away after that. And, you know, I was a very slow writer at that time. Mm-hmm. And who knows, maybe that was the peak of instrumental guitar for me because I'd already been playing it all through the 80s, right? So it ended with that record, my first record, right? And then I just wanted to keep evolving. And I never cared what happened.
I should ask it differently, not the word success, but I should ask what is important to you?
It's just what I do. I mean, there's no way around it. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be here without it.
Yeah. It's not a choice.
Yeah. It's just, I mean, I wouldn't know what to do with myself if I wasn't making music, you know? Mm-hmm. So even though I don't release a lot of material, I'm always trying, usually 100% or even more and too much, right? Except for, you know, those couple of years where I just kind of started going into acoustic and playing less and valuing it more and not looking at it as a, you know, and I still don't anymore. I don't practice a lot. I just play if I feel like it. But yeah, it's just, it's everything. So it's not a choice to be commercial. It's not a choice to even let people hear it. Mm-hmm. I'm happy making it and I'm even happy if nobody hears it. It's that important just to me. So, I mean, if it was easier to put stuff out, maybe, you know, without the, you know, Spotify and all that, they take all the money, but still I don't have material to release right now. Mm-hmm. I just have probably 50, 60, 70 songs that I'm working on that, and they more keep coming every month.
It should be another business model besides Spotify and a CD. Should be another form for the way you work, right? I mean,
yeah. So I don't know. Again, you know, until I have finished product and I'm real close to having things, and I have a little plan that I might put into action when in this year or the beginning of next year, whatever I can pull off. But and that I may have to put it out on Spotify. I don't know. I mean, they're not going to dissolve by January, and I don't see a new thing happening yet. So. I'll probably have to put something out on that format, but,
Hey, and what role, because you mentioned, I see it more as art form. Yeah. What role is touring in that art form for you? Or is that completely a different world?
No, it's still an art form because I'm improvising most of the time.
Yeah.
You know, I'm either improvising like I did on this Jeff Beck thing with all those improvised solos.
Yeah. Just finished this Jeff Beck tour.
Yeah. So we were improvising all the solos that I would mimic a couple things here and there that would evolve as the show would go on. But the, if I'm not doing that, then I'm playing my own music, which I really, that's very challenging. And I do have a side of me that, it likes the vocal songs and the slide guitar and all that stuff. It's very challenging. It's very fulfilling. So, but it's also hard because every time you tour, you say, okay, what songs am I going to play this time? Right. And then it's like, okay, those same old instrumental songs, which I enjoy playing more now than even a long time ago. But then you just wonder if people are going, where's your new album, or this, you know, right, things like this. Right. So this Jeff Beck thing was a nice way to get out and play. And
not too many players would dare playing Jeff stuff.
Well,
like, you pulled it off. I mean, yeah. It's like, whoa.
Well, it wasn't even about the guitar. It was just those songs.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And so it was more about the songs, and that's why I got Chad and Stu.
Yeah.
And so
Chad Wackerman and Stu Hamm.
Yeah. So we could play those songs and just have the whole, from the 70s through the guitar shop thing. But it's just different. I just think the art of playing live and having to, just do the thing. You know, you have to have a show, you have to have the song list. But the most important thing is you set up and play, the show ends, and you at least have completion for one day.
Mm.
And you usually don't get that in the music business.
Mm.
Nothing ever really gets completed. So every day that Zen mode of completion happens.
That's interesting.
And that's fulfilling too. Because I've always been a pretty good traveler,
mm-hmm.
Knock on wood for now,
eat on time. Yeah, that's right. Important, right?
Yeah. The eating, that's the hardest part, but luckily I can, deal with it. And, I love it. Like I can play every day. Like I could just, I prefer to play every single day, mm-hmm. and I could probably do that mm-hmm. for a couple of months. But it's tough. You get tired. I'm still adjusting to the time zone over here.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes after, like, you're after 2 weeks, you'll just be doing great. Mm-hmm. And then you'll crash. Mm-hmm. You'll just start.
And then you go back home.
Yeah, yeah. So that, but still, I'm lucky. I'm handling it well. And mm-hmm. I love doing it. And I love sweating buckets of sweat and eating whatever I want and mm-hmm. moving on down the road and
mm-hmm.
Completion at the end of the night. That's great. Yeah.
But that with you writing your music, is there anybody with who you can reflect on your songs and who can help you with having that completion when you write the songs?
Well, I'm getting better at mixing.
Mm.
So that's the hardest.
But do you have anybody who you say, hey, he's a reference for me?
Like, nope.
Nope.
I don't.
Okay, just yourself.
Yeah.
Okay.
I trust my own
mm-hmm.
everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Because somebody, they just don't have, they'll never want to love it as much as I do.
Mm.
And they may just, it's just going to be a passing thought for them.
Mm.
They're going to stop by, they're going to say something,
yeah.
and they're going to say, oh, that sounds like, you know, Pink Floyd or something. And you'll be like, well,
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Now you'll think that every time you hear it. It sounds like Pink Floyd.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so I don't want to hear anybody's opinion
mm-hmm.
of any of it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the fact that we have home studios now is beneficial to that. Nobody gets to hear any of it mm-hmm. ever
mm-hmm.
until I'm done with it.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that. And it sucks because even when you have to have a guy mix it for you, then that's just always, that's even harder because then they're getting to hear all the individual tracks. And not that I care if people hear my mistakes. It's not about that. They just are never going to hear it like you do. Like they'll never hear the blend.
Mm.
The blend and we all have different hearing and we all have hearing damage.
Yes.
You know, so, and I'm working with people with hearing damage because they've been doing it.
Yes.
Right. So, you know, and people don't like to hear loud guitar anymore. They keep telling you to turn down.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So,
yeah.
You know, I'm just going to do it my way.
You still play with two cabinets, right? Two amps.
There was just one, but the,
no? Oh, you put the top on the side.
Yeah.
But okay.
I use all kinds of stuff. That was just, you know, that was another thing that was hard to tour.
Mm.
It's just, you know, I'm going from no gigs from 2018, right? And I've been playing through the same amp for 6 years
mm-hmm.
and I haven't touched the dials once
mm-hmm.
and I have a perfect studio situation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too perfect,
mm-hmm.
right? So I don't have a relationship between guitar and amp right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm figuring that out again. And we only had 3-4 hour rehearsals for this tour.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I had to go from no relationship with an amp,
mm-hmm.
no standing playing for 6 years,
mm-hmm.
and three four hour rehearsals where you really can't get loud.
Wow, yeah.
You know, yeah. And so I didn't get to even do that in the rehearsals, even use the gear that I'm going to use. So I had to come here. Luckily, we had one rehearsal and I was able to try the amp that I'd be using and turn it up and hopefully it works. And, you know, there was no other choice. Luckily, it was a Marshall. And yeah. I can get along with Marshalls, and it was an old one, and it worked. Yeah. But I've been playing through a 77 Marshall.
It sounded like you.
Yeah, thank God. Yeah. Thank God it all worked out. You know? Yeah. But it was funny. We played a gig where everything was fucking wrong. Mm. Everything. It was terrible. Mm. Everything was so terrible. We walked in. It was a giant gymnasium, like an Olympic-sized gymnasium. Like, it was the most reverb I ever heard when I was on a stage, right? And and it was just terrible. And then and we had to fly to the gig, so I didn't even have the Marshall. It was a Laney. And it didn't sound good. Laneys are great amps, but this one didn't sound good. And they had an effects loop, and it didn't work because they forgot to bring the pedal. So then there was this little 20-watt Vox amp. Mm-hmm. And so I had to use that, and that did have an effects loop, and I made it work. And, you know, it may have sounded better than the Marshall. And this was, you know, but we had to work on it and go through all these problems that the sound was having. And the gig ended up being great, you know, because people came in and filled up some of that reverb. It was still just a terrible tank, but it sounded great for solos then.
Oh, yeah.
There's a nice natural reverb in this giant chamber. So that was good, but it was still hard to hear your band on stage. But yeah, so I had to, I'm just kind of starting over. You know, when I don't tour for years at a time, it feels like you're starting over again for a lot of things. So it's very stressful. I mean, extremely stressful, because I know what it's like to play regularly. Cause I was doing that earlier in like 2010, 11, 12. I just had more playing. I don't like starting over again with that stuff. And I had to do that. So, but you know, I'll go 2 years without touring and not standing up, not playing, and I'll walk right into it.
That's also so. You usually sit playing at home,
sitting in the studio. No standing. So I was worried that I was going to stand and be like, "Oh, this is way harder." And luckily, that wasn't a problem. It seemed like it felt good to stand and play. You know, so that was good, because you can kind of put your self into the whammy bar and that. So that's kind of good. But
it helped that. With Stu Hamm and Chad Wackerman.
Right.
They are great, right?
Right, I mean, yeah. So, exactly. When I wasn't worried about them at all. Mm. So that was great. Because usually, you know, it's a team effort and you're working with guys that are going through the same thing you're going through. Oh, man, I haven't done this or done that.
Yeah.
Well, those guys, they're playing all the time, usually doing things. So that wasn't the case. They were ready to go. And that's why they can just do 3-4 hour rehearsals, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm more stressed about that. I'd put you through 12 rehearsals all day if I could, right? And nobody's going to do that. Mm-hmm. So,
but is that striving for perfection or also insecurity or
all that? Oh yeah. Oh yeah. But the rehearsals, the before we started this tour, I was miserable.
Yeah.
I thought this is terrible. I'm terrible.
Mm, yeah.
This whole thing's terrible.
Oh
yeah. Oh, it's miserable. And you second guess your entire everything. And for a couple of days, right?
How do you get out of that?
It just,
what helps?
It you know, well, hearing a good guitar tone in a loud guitar, and you know, your sound is happening, but we weren't really able to do that. It was just, you know, it was little sections of rehearsals, and then we had to fly over here and then set up in this club, and it was just baby steps the whole way, right? And then I can't remember when it changed, but it was before the first gig, thank God. It was right after, I think, our last rehearsal, something changed. But then the first gig was really great. So it probably changed then, right? Because everyone brings their A game to the gig, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a rehearsal anymore. Mm-hmm. So then, and people showed up. And I've played these clubs before, and sometimes they're not full, and these were more full than usual. And so, so that was good.
It's a boost for your confidence.
Yeah, and the gigs were good. And you know, Stu and Chad sounded great. And a couple of things evolved to be good that I was didn't like before on some of the material. And so it just, that all came, it changes overnight all of a sudden.
To me, it's interesting because I met some other artists before who had the same feeling of like, I can't do it. I'm miserable. And then I'm seeing them on stage. I'm like, whoa, you're great. That seems like such a big difference. Like,
well, that's the harder part about being an artist.
Yeah.
You do that to yourself through your whole life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, and it's, so I don't try to do that anymore. And maybe, if I can write material, then I'm happy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm writing. I wasn't writing material, I don't know what I'd be doing. I wouldn't put any effort into any of the rest of it. I wouldn't say, I'll just play live and play Jeff Beck tours. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't even play anymore.
Yeah. But you don't have that feeling of insecurity while composing and writing. That's just like, okay, this needs to get out of there.
Right. Now, so every once in a while you'll have a song and you'll be really excited about it. Mm-hmm. And then when you first start to go do the vocals or something, you'll be like, oh man, this isn't working the way I thought. Mm-hmm. But you get better at that. You kind of have a blueprint of certain types of songs that you do. So you kind of know certain things are going to work now. Right. So, and when they do, that's great. And every once in a while you're shattered by, that's just not what I thought. This was my best song, I thought, and now it's not, you know. And then, you know, sometimes you can fix it up. Like that hurt makes you kind of try really hard, and then you do fix it up and then you make it happen. But sometimes it's not. But other than that, I'm happy if I'm writing new material that even if I only like the new riff for a couple of days.
Yeah.
I'm playing it all day for a couple of days. I'm just like, oh, this is my new thing. And, you know, and then I move on to the next one, unfortunately you'll forget you even did any of it, even if it's great. And you'll say, that's my best song. Mm-hmm. And you'll forget you even did it because you're three songs ahead of that now with new material. And so that's the problem of writing a lot. And I have been, you literally forget everything about that old song from 3 months ago, because you've got to let the new songs come or you're not as happy.
You
can't just play those old. So you can't just play something for years, you know. It's got to keep moving, and thank God that it is, you know, because then I wouldn't want to do it, you know.
But it's interesting to me. You're really writing, playing guitar as a way of life, and like the success or the lack of success, that's all besides it all, right? You're going to do this anyway.
Yeah. and you know, I meet lots of musicians.
Yeah.
They don't understand me at all because of that. Mm. You would think that these musicians would be the only people that understand you. Mm. No.
But tell me, what do they say?
Well, because you're working with people who are side guys who don't write music.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So I'm sitting here telling people, I don't even want to be on this earth if I can't write material.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And they go, oh, and you know, they either don't get that at all, you know, because you're too deep into it, you know, and these are guys that play with, you know, bands every week and they're amazing musicians and maybe they write a little bit, but they don't write for their life. Right. So they don't understand you at all. In fact, a non-musician has more understanding than some of these guys. And I run into that everywhere I go, musicians who don't get it because I'm just not out there selling it like some guys do. And I'm impressed with people that have every day they're selling their shit. You know, I'm here. I am, and here's my
it's
video.
It's a difficult part, man. My energy is not there either.
You can't do it. My energy goes into the writing, because then that's what makes me my best chance at actually being successful would be to have a lot of material.
Yeah,
and I'm building it up, and so otherwise, I've never been a side guy. I it just never worked out. It's not that I didn't want to be, it just didn't go that direction. So that's just the way it is.
For some reason, the image of a painter pops up in my head. It's like somebody who has to paint.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I don't care if I sell it or not. It just has to happen.
Yeah. Because you're lucky if you can do that. Mm. If you can find the privacy, mm-hmm. and then the privacy, and then the years that you put into trying to even know how to do that, right? To have privacy equals, okay, maybe I'll play for 20 minutes and that first thing works, right? So I'm getting more of that than I ever thought I could get. Mm-hmm. And that's just, that's the best it'll be.
But maybe to almost wrap this up, I can imagine that if you, once you do release it, some sort of value is being stamped upon it, right? Like, okay, there's so many people listen to it, or it has sold this many records. And that must also be a strange aspect of it all. Or maybe you even prefer not releasing it. So then that does not happen. You understand? It's not really a question I'm asking, but do you understand my way of thinking?
That's interesting. Cause yeah, I remember, when I put out my last album, there was, what was it? 2013. I mean, I can't come up with a year that's worse for selling new music than a guy like me, without a major promotional or opening for a band that's, more famous, and stuff like that. So it wasn't that record didn't sell hardly anything, And, I don't think anyone even tried to sell it. I don't think the label tried very much to sell it, because everyone was just pooped on trying to sell records in 2013.
Yeah.
I think that it's even probably worse now in some ways, but at least everyone's accepted. You're just going to go online and that's it, But that didn't bother me. No, getting the thing done it took so long to get it done that I was just relieved. And unfortunately, you don't want anything to do with it. Right after that, you're ready to move on with your new music. And so I probably didn't even promote it like I should have. But, I've sold some out on the road. I've sold copies of that. So, but I don't really care what it sells. I don't know even what that, what do they have a ticker on Spotify now? Who knows? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't. And magazines don't really, I don't understand their motivations anymore either. Like, nobody contacted me about me and Stu Hamm and Chad Wackerman doing this Jeff Beck tribute. Like, no guitar magazines contacted me. You know what? I kind of like that. Let's just keep it that way.
Sorry, I contacted you, Mike.
if it's gonna be like that, it's just kind of interesting. I'm thinking like, okay, I guess we're just past. I'm an old fogey now. I'm going to be 57 next month, so I guess I'll accept that. And I do. I like being the old guy, underdog. I really do.
Yeah.
So, we'll see where the world heads. I mean, there's going to be great new music from young guys, but now we're in an era where the old guys are making great music too.
Yeah.
Warren Haynes and Government Mule and, a lot of bands are, there's a lot of new artists, young and old. And so there'd be cool stuff coming out from all kinds of people. And so I want to compete. I think I'm good enough to compete in the world. And I want to write a song that competes, not that I'm trying to write one that gets there, but just some of my material, I just hope it turns out to the point where I'm proud to release it in a way where, I can compete with anyone else out there as a writer. You know what I mean? Because, there's just so many different styles. It doesn't have to be a save the world Beatles song. Just, put out a decent tune, that has got a good vibe. So
makes me very curious. Thank you so much for your time, Michael.
Yeah,
Mike Lee Firkins, and listeners also.
All right.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you.